I'm Fern Cotton, and this is Happy Place. Now, every now and then, I introduce you to someone who is an absolute game changer. Today is one of those episodes.
When I think about, you know, when my oldest daughter, she had this pain in her stomach, and every night the mother-to-be had to carry her back and forth at the floor in our flat. It was terrible. It was like torture. But today, many years later, I think about those nights as some of the happiest in my life.
It's Erling Kagger, and he's, well, quite a lot of things, actually, including a polar explorer, an entrepreneur, a lawyer, and an art dealer. Not bad, eh? But what we're talking about is silence. Tricky for a podcast, but we're going to embrace it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, here is the show. Thank you so much for appearing on the podcast. We've sort of been email pen pals for a little while now.
Yeah.
Which has been lovely.
Absolutely.
Due to your phenomenal book, Silence, which I've loved all of your books. These gorgeous books that allow us to really take the wisdom that you've learned on your adventures and your explorations. And I thank you for that because I've loved reading them so much. And then I thought, I've got to get you to contribute to one of my books. So I cheekily got your email address and you said yes.
Of course. Of course. I was older. I was very happy. Yeah.
Well, I was so chuffed that you did. And then we were just chatting about all sorts of stuff to do with the books, your books, my books. And then I think I emailed you to ask you to come on Radio 2.
Yeah.
And you said yes, which was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And your chat on Radio 2 went down so well because that wasn't the regular kind of chat they would have in the morning. So it was a lovely moment. And then I guess we've just emailed back and forth. Like, you've sent me some beautiful pictures of your like log cabin in Norway.
You should come.
I really want
to. Bring your man.
But I'm
You'll
scared
never forget it.
Of the no electricity thing. I am scared about that.
I might not have told you, but you know, it's not only the thing that there are absolutely no cabins, no people around. And it's no electricity, but it's no running water. It's a lake 15 or 20 inches away from the cabin, so it's water available. And it's not even a toilet. So you have the world's biggest toilet around you.
Wow. So you're just out there digging a little hole and...
Hardly a hole.
Yeah. Just go for it.
Yeah.
This is why I've been slow to take up the offer, but I do feel it would be a wonderful
your
experience.
Your husband will be very impressed by it.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to have to say yes.
You might find some silent moments up there.
Well, there you go. That's the whole point. You're the first person to have completed the Three Poles Challenge, so North Pole, South Pole, and Everest. What initially drove you to partake in a challenge like that? What was the reason behind it? What was that feeling, that impetus that drove you to do it?
I think, first of all, we are born explorers. If you look at Homo sapiens, it was the possibility to walk on two legs that made us into human beings. And that spirit of exploration in a physical sense is, you know, eventually 300,000 years later got us, you know, to walk on the moon and also make your kids to walk on, you know, into the streets. So I think, you know, this is something we're all born with. Obviously, that spirit is corrupted due to kindergarten and school and family and friends, but it never goes away. So I think, you know, it's just my spirit is slightly stronger than, you know, for others. But, you know, I think we're all We're all explorers in one way.
So you would have gone through the usual kind of schooling system like any of us and perhaps had teenage years where that feeling was slightly diluted and it wasn't as strong? Or did you always have this sense that you needed adventure and that you wanted to go out and see the world in a different way?
I always had that sense. Wow. For sure. I was dreaming about sailing around the world from a very young age. And later I didn't sail around the whole world, but at least half the world. And
that's quite a lot of the world.
But you know, it's very much about making life more difficult than necessary, because in one way, obviously, you hardly need to do anything, at least not if you're born in Norway like I am, because we're very much a spoiled society. So you know, from we get up in the morning or from we wake up in the morning, it's all about making difficult options and to make life meaningful. And for me, you know, I took it to some extremes.
You don't say. Because most people, you know, I'm certainly guilty of this. Sometimes you do want the easier route in life. You do want the easier options, something that feels more comfortable. Again, as that need to challenge yourself and go for a more difficult route always been omnipresent in your life?
No. One of the chapters in Philosophy for Polar Explorers, I'm writing about that. You know, usually, you know, you have to make the choices throughout every day, easiest options and more difficult options. And usually I opt for the easiest option. That's, you know, that's how we were born. But when I look back on my life as I write about, I think it has usually been a mistake to go for the easiest options. I think in general, as human beings, we're better off making our lives and our choices more difficult than they have to be.
So what are we missing out on by choosing the easy option?
You know, if you think about one of the meanings of life, obviously life has several meanings, but one of the meanings of life is to fulfill the potentials you were born with or the potentials you have. Then, you know, you actually have to get up in the morning. You have to have some action. You have to, you know, to challenge yourself and challenge the environment. So I think, you know, if you don't do it, you know, you tend to regret it. Like, yeah. Today I'm 57 years old and,
Sorry. That's like, I haven't got cake or anything.
I wish I could bluff you on that one, but no, but when I look at my friends, they, you know, they tend to complain that life is short.
Yeah.
And the older you get, you know, the shorter the life you have lived feels. But of course that's, that's a huge misunderstanding, and people are mixing up the law of physics with how they perceive their own life. Mm. Because life is long if you don't waste it.
And also, when I was reading your book, I got a sense of that, but I got a sense also that it's not about how much you do and how much you cram in and how much you try and do each day, but it's much more about how present you are, even in the moments which are, you know, seemingly nothing's really going on. Is that how you would say sort of lengthen time or experience that, you know, or to lessen panic that time's running out?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's about very much about enjoying the silence, I think. And I enjoy the silence, not throughout, you know, every day, but, you know, every now and then. And sometimes, of course, when I'm in out in nature, it's easier. But I think, you know, one of the reasons life feels very short is because we have this high speed every day. And of course, when you have a high speed, somehow time narrows in.
Yeah.
And also it's about living in noise. And when I write about noise, I'm not writing about the opposite of sounds. I think about noise as obviously could be sounds, but it could also be distractions, frustrations, a radio running, cars passing, man-made light during the night. And of course, young people today, they will spend about 4 hours every day on social media. Mm. And if you live until 84, as you probably do in England, that means you're on social media 13 years of your life, day
and
night.
Depressing.
And of course, you know, then life feels short because you tend to do the same every day. And when you get older, you start to feel that you have wasted this one huge opportunity to have a rich life.
Yeah. And let's talk about silence, because you've experienced silence like most of us will never. Silence is so rare in this day and age. Like you say on the front of your book, we're in the age of noise, which is perfectly put. Everything is noisy. You can hear builders downstairs right now in my house. There is noise everywhere. There are cars going past. There are planes. It's constant and it's hard to escape it. I got a teeny, teeny slither of proper silence last year. I emailed you about this. I went to Finland with my family and we were really far up north of a tiny place called Kittilä, and it was beautiful, and there were no cars, there were no planes overhead, there was no flight path, there was no wind, so everything was like very eerily still. And it was kind of overwhelming, that silence, because I realized I really haven't felt it, experienced it before. Obviously on your expeditions, and I guess more specifically, correct me if I'm wrong, your trek to the South Pole, where you were completely on your own, unsupported. Can you even describe that level of silence?
But I think, you know, the beauty of what you just said is that the silence you experienced, you know, it's a good example on, like, which I think is important to keep in mind, that silence is not about turning you back to the world. It's not about living a more egocentric life. It's more about the opposite. It's about seeing the world. It's about loving the people and loving nature even more. So I think that's important to keep in mind. But, you know, when you walk to the Antarctic, to the South Pole through the Antarctic, as I did for 50 days and nights under the midnight sun, one thing which is interesting is that it's almost absolutely silent. I don't think you find a total silent place anywhere. But the silence was kind of growing on me, and also the nature. So in the sense that after a few weeks, you start to feel that your body doesn't stop by your fingertips, but kind of extended into the nature. You're becoming a part of the environment. And you also start to have a dialogue with the environment, with the nature. You're sending some ideas out and you get all the thoughts back again. So you're very much present in your own life. You don't think about the future nor the past. And somehow, you know, you feel that your mind can be greater than the universe. And that's a beautiful feeling, but you can have kind of a similar feeling, I think, also if you do some hiking in England in nature. Maybe not that strong, but I think, you know, I think people kind of underestimating their own possibilities in life to experience this kind of deep silence.
Was this an epiphany you had during that specific trek, or was it something you were almost anticipating? You knew that perhaps you wanted to seek out that silence and that it might have something for you?
It's lovely, you know, it's when I was a kid, I felt that silence was about being let out. It was about not having anyone to play with. It was about sadness, boredom, that kind of stuff, which I think is normal. But in late teenagers, early 20s, I started to understand that silence is super important. And so I was fully aware of it before I started to walk to the South Pole, but that expedition learned me an important lesson, and also that those expeditions, different expeditions combined with being an entrepreneur in Norway, book publisher, writing books, and eventually getting three daughters kind of made it possible for me to write these books. Only the experience walking to the South Pole was not enough, but I think, you know, the combination turned me into an author.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So what have you noticed, or what did you notice in that moment, were the benefits of silence? Because I think there'll still be people listening saying, right, I get it, we need more peace and quiet, but what is it? What is it that... what is it about the silence that changes your life for the better, or your mind? Or, you know, there's that lovely thing you just said about feeling at one with nature, and we all need that more, my God. But what else is it? How could it benefit all of us?
I think, you know, noise is very much about other people. It's very much about man-made, you know, technology and man-made stuff. It's very much about running away from yourself. It's very much about living through other people. While silence is about discovering yourself. And that's, of course, why we prefer noise, because it's easier. Yeah. While, you know, listening to yourself could be complicated. It could be uncomfortable. It could be frustrating. So that's why we try to avoid it. But, you know, in silence, we meet ourselves. And in silence is somehow, you know, facing the biggest secrets of life. And of course, if you're religious, you believe you find God in silence. But, you know, at least you definitely, you know, will explore yourself.
Isn't it funny? Because I was going to ask you, why are we so scared of silence? But you've just sort of answered it. We're scared to meet ourselves. Yeah. We don't want to sit there and have possibly undesirable thoughts come up, you know, bad thoughts about ourselves, about the past. I'm wondering if you experienced that level of negativity and how you dealt with it in solitude, because you were on your own for so long, certainly on the solo venture. How did you mitigate that level of negative noise?
You know, it's I'm writing about this anecdote about Marina Abramović, the artist, who her biggest desire was to experience silence. So she went into a desert and sat down by herself, hardly any noise around her. And then she wanted to listen to the silence, listen to herself. But then she had all this noise in her head. Because, of course, you just keep on thinking. And when you think about the past or the future. And that's another way, you know, of noise. So, and that's frustrating. That's something I have experienced a lot too. And I think it's very common. As soon as, you know, you turn off your phone or don't look at your phone, you have all this noise in your head. Because you're thinking about what's going on. But somehow you need to empty your head. You need to think a little bit less sometimes. And that's difficult. And it should be difficult. But, you know, maybe it takes you 30 seconds, maybe it takes you a few hours. But then you have this beautiful feeling of being present in your own life.
And so did you experience that when you were on your solo trek? How long did it take you to get to the point where you went, that noise is gone?
Took me a few days to the South Pole, but also when I've been sailing across the oceans, it takes you a few days. But in daily life, I usually walk to my office, takes me 35 minutes. And sometimes I feel so important that I have to talk on the phone, but usually I turn off the phone. I'm not holding anything in my hands. And I walk in peace to the office, and, you know, then I find silence. Not as deep as to the South Pole, but still I find silence. I think, you know, the most important silence in life is not around you, outside you, but, you know, it's inside your own mind, inside your own body, and it's there waiting for you to explore it. And so I find silence, you know, on these daily walks. I find silence when I take a shower, sometimes when I do the dishes. And, you know, I find inner silence throughout the whole day, sometimes for a few seconds, other times, you know, for longer.
Because you talk prolifically about inner silence in the book. And for some people, I think that will seem like a very alien concept, you know, having any space in the day, let alone your head, where there is peace. Because I think most of our battles are, you know, fought within our own minds and conflicting thoughts and feelings, and for many people, myself included, it can at times feel like you can't even locate that inner silence. Would you say the best ways are just to simply get out in nature to allow yourself that time and space?
I think nature is a fantastic place to do it.
Yeah,
and I think one of the reasons, major reasons in society today, is that we have disconnected from nature. That's why, you know, I wrote those three books because I felt I had something really important to say about, you know, that we need to relate to Mother Earth because it's 4.5 billion years old, and somehow we know the kind of the first generation who starts to believe that we can forget about Mother Earth, that we are stronger and better and better off without thinking about nature. But that's a mistake. But it's but still, I think, you know, you can find silence anywhere. I think, you know, even here in London, you can find it at sitting in the middle of Piccadilly Circus, and you will find silence. So it's more a matter about attitude, and that you actually are willing, and also that you dare to listen to yourself.
That's the thing, I think, daring to do it, because we could palm it off and say, oh, you know, silence is boring, or what's the point? But like you say, if there's that fear of meeting ourselves in that silence, there's obviously some work to be done. There's obviously like some things to unpick and some issues that need to be dealt with, because otherwise we just distract ourselves further and they, I guess, get bigger because you're suppressing them all. Why do we find it awkward to sit in silence with other humans? Because that's, especially for British people, you know, you would never sit and, you know, unless you knew someone really well. Like, I could sit with my husband and not talk and I wouldn't take offence and he wouldn't. But to even sit...
That's very good for you.
Yeah. I think to even sit with someone that you know quite well, it's a weird awkwardness about it. Why is that?
I think that's very human.
Yeah.
People can't stand silence. And that's not something new. Philosophers have been writing about it. Blaise Pascal wrote about it in 1640s, that the origin of all the problems we have is our inability to sit alone in a room doing nothing. And instead of doing nothing, we do something, and that's where all the problems begin. And of course, that was a problem in 1640s for us, but it's today the challenge is so much bigger.
Oh, yeah.
But for me, of course, you know, it could be uncomfortable sometimes to sit with someone not saying anything. But, you know, if you look at the Japanese, they have so much silence in their language, so much silence in daily lives. And that's also a way to communicate. And especially, I think, you know, you mentioned your husband. I think, you know, for me, with girlfriends, has always been a problem when we have to explain everything with words. I think that's really hard to survive in a relationship if you have to put words. Also because quite a few things in life, you know, you can't describe by words. It's too complicated. And we don't have, you know, sufficient of words in the world. And then, you know, you have to express it by, you know, the way you behave, the way you sit, the way you think, the way you look at the other person, the way you kind of hug the other person. Yeah, and it's all about, you know, that part is about silence.
So how do you balance, I guess, your drive to do and to complete huge challenges with also your very well-versed knowledge in knowing you need to just be and stop? How do you dance around with those two thoughts?
Ooh, I wish I had one short answer on that one. But I think, you know, you never find a perfect balance in life for long. Maybe you have a perfect balance for some seconds or minutes or maybe even for a few days if you're fortunate. But, you know, everything's changing all the time. So that balance is, you know, only for, you know, short periods.
And so do you know when you've done too much and you need to just relax and draw back, or is that drive so insatiable that you just do need a new challenge? Because, you know, as you said, you've not only done these crazy physical challenges, but also even in your life with, you know, how you run your business and being a publisher, they're all huge challenges. Do you have to find peace within it, or do you really need to retreat sometimes and just step away from it all?
I definitely need to retreat. Mostly by, you know, doing some hiking, skiing in the forest or in the mountains. But again, you know, life is not perfect. Sometimes I just, you know, very, very tired and frustrated and, you know, being awake at night because things I haven't done or things, you know, ideas I, you know, don't come to terms with. So, and also with three daughters, of course, it's, you know, it's life is very much about noise.
It is. I know that one. I loved your more recent book, Philosophy for Polar Explorers, because you've very succinctly put your real big findings, your big learnings from those expeditions into everyday life, how we can apply the things that you learned in those tougher times just to, you know, anyone that's never even been on a hike before. And I love that concept. I'd love to talk about a few of them. So one of them is getting up early.
Yeah, I used to find pleasure in sleeping long hours in the morning. But I learned a hard way on expeditions and also with small kids that you have to get up in the morning. Mm. And I think, you know, it's a bigger challenge being a polar explorer is to get up in the morning when it's 50 degrees below. And you always feel for freezing a little bit for 5 minutes or 5 hours to stay in the sleeping bag instead of going out of the sleeping bag and freeze like hell. But, you know, somehow the days become so much better when you get up in the morning. So I think that's a good start. But it's not a religion. So, I mean, sometimes I sleep for long hours. And I think it's important to sleep for many hours. But, you know, you have to get up in the morning.
So what time would be your sort of optimum time to get up, start the day on your perfect day?
6:30. So not super early. It's just about, you know, having some discipline in your life. And, you know, if you have some discipline, it's also, you know, it's nice to break your own rules too sometimes, but, you know, it's a good start to have some discipline,
because obviously, you know, you have to have that discipline when you're on a trek, especially I'm imagining on a solo venture, because you've got no one to make you motivated or no. to pull you out of that sleeping sack. You've got to go, right, this is my structure for what could be quite, you know, a rogue day of doing whatever I want. And I like the application of that into everyday life, because sometimes we see freedom as being, you know, no rules. We can do whatever we want. We don't have to stick to a system or have a routine. But actually, your philosophy is there's a lot of joy in having that routine. And then, as you say, sort of breaking those rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a huge misunderstanding today to think about freedom as living a life without responsibilities.
Yes.
Because it's the opposite. Of course, you need then responsibilities to be able to live a free life.
Mm.
And that's something you learn, you know, as a family man or a mother, of course, and also on expeditions. And it took me a long time to understand it, because when I was younger, I thought, you know, less responsibilities, more freedom. And I was wrong.
Mm. And then what about train yourself in optimism? First of all, how did you use that concept when you were trekking?
Somehow to me it seems like optimists have a better life than pessimists.
Mm.
And also optimists, historical wise, to me seems to have been more right than pessimists. And in daily life, I think sometimes it's could be a struggle to be optimistic, but you know, I think it's important to be a little bit optimistic, not in a stupid way, but I have traveled to more than 100 countries and met thousands of people, and my impression is that most people underestimate themselves.
Yeah.
And the possibilities of life. And in the book you mentioned, I have this little anecdote about this elephants in Bangalore, and a guy asked this owner of the elephants, how come all these huge elephants, you know, don't run away, because they're only tied to this little tiny stake with a thin rope to the ground. And the guy says, you know, when the elephants are small, when they're babies, we tie them with this thin rope to this little stake in the ground, and they're not able to escape, and an elephant will never try again. And I think that's, you know, that's how we humans are, yeah, quite often too. So, you know, it's when you're thinking about it, I think, you know, it slowly turns kind of obvious that we have to try to be optimistic.
Mm. But it's tricky, isn't it? Because with that elephant anecdote, you know, we've all been that elephant. We've all been told you cannot move from here, or you won't progress, or you're not good enough, or whatever. How do we get that strength to negate those statements and say, you know what, I know you've told me that you don't think that's possible, but I'm going to do it anyway. How do you think we draw from that inner strength?
I think that's one of the biggest challenges in life.
Yeah.
You know, you'll see every boy has a problematic relationship to his father, and every father has a problematic relationship to his son. And that, you know, that could, you can come over it, but for sure in the beginning of your life. And one of the reasons is that, you know, fathers tell their sons, you're not able to do it, you're not good enough, don't do that, it's not going to work out. And you tend to believe it. Just like if you tell a kid that you are an awful drawer, you know, you will believe it for the rest of your life that you can't, you know, make a drawing. So, you know, I don't have a proper formula for getting out of it. But I think, you know, to have knowledge about it, to know it, that's how life is for most people, not only for you, but for almost everybody else, I think it's a good start. Yeah. Because if you're not aware of it, or if you refuse to think about it and accept it, then I think it's super hard to get out to it. Mm. And I was struggling with it for many years throughout my teenagers, that I find it very problematic to satisfy my father, to impress my father. I really want to impress my father. I didn't manage, at least he didn't express it. And while your mother is kind of love you anyway, and she's there. And so then it's easier to kind of not think too much about your mother, but, you know, focus on your father.
So do you think some of your drive to do these big challenges has been subliminally to kind of to show your dad that you can do it and that you're worthy and that you can do impressive things?
I think you do it, you know, whatever you do for many reasons. So I walked to the poles and sailed the oceans and climbed mountains for many, many reasons, you know, only to be, you know, close to nature. But I think one of the reasons, yes, at least early on, was to somehow compensate, you know, for having, you know, a bit rough childhood and to impress or satisfy my dad, yes.
I think so many people will relate to that, and, you know, whether it could even be a teacher or a friend, but someone in the back of your mind that is there, that you kind of want to see your success and what you've achieved. I can definitely relate to that. When we get into these negative cycles of thought, which we all do, that we're perhaps not good enough or we're not capable, what's your way of snapping out of that? Because, of course, if you are on a solo expedition or you've got a huge physical challenge ahead, there's really no time to allow those voices to take hold because it's a matter of survival. So have you got any techniques or ways that you can snap yourself out of a negative thinking cycle to be optimistic?
Oh, again, I wish I had, you know, something easy to say, but I think it's these negative circles are something we all have, we're all struggling with, also on an expedition to the South Pole. And of course, then it's in one way harder because you're by yourself. But on the other hand, I think it's important to keep in mind that all negativity needs refill. So any emotion needs to have, you know, some more gasoline, you know, to fill up, to keep up the emotion. So I think quite often you just have to ride it out. I mean, it lasts maybe for a few minutes, maybe it lasts for some hours or days. But if it eventually it will stop.
So did you have moments on that specific trek where you were close to just giving up and saying, you know what, this is too much, I don't want to do this anymore?
No, I have to disappoint you. I've never, it sounds a bit strange, maybe I've never considered giving up.
Yeah.
Because somehow to give up is even worse than keep on going. Mm. And I think, you know, sometimes in life you have to give up. You have to take a loss because it doesn't make sense anymore. I mean, if you're in love with a girl and, you know, she does not in love with you for a long, long time, you know, eventually you have to give up or whatever. But it's I think on expeditions, but also, you know, other parts of my life, I have been good at not giving up. And I think also quite often people give up too easily. Obviously, some people keep, you know, on for too long, which turns into a sad story. But I think, you know, to just kind of not give up.
And like you say, that optimism has parameters. You know, it can't tip into stupidity or doing things that are foolish. So how do you tread that line of knowing that your dreams are realistic?
Sometimes they're not. And I think especially when I was a kid, I had, you know, these ideas about becoming a greater boxer than Muhammad Ali, world champion in football, etc., 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 and become a fireman and sailing the world, etc. And, you know, that's because you're born with this kind of 360 degrees horizon. So I think in one way it's good that you learn the hard way that you're not able to succeed with all your dreams. And of course, if you do expeditions like I've been doing or starting a business or writing books, you don't know if you're going to be successful. But I think, you know, life is also about taking risks. And again, you know, I think, you know, it's to make life, you know, interesting and make it rich, you need to take a few risks. And of course, you know, to start a family is a huge risk. To get married is a huge risk. And I have to say, to me, it was much more demanding to raise three kids than walk into the South Pole, because, you know, walking to the South Pole was 2 years of preparations and 50 days cross-country skiing, while having a family is, you know...
Parenting's so bloody hard, isn't it? I mean, it's just... We all talk about how brilliant it is, and we know it is. It's the most joyful thing ever, but... Holy hell, it is so hard sometimes.
But that's a beautiful life. You tend to forget all the, you know, the rough things. And I also think, as I write about in the last book, this kind of this whole idea about being happy all the time, I think it's another big misunderstanding. Because when I think about, you know, with my oldest daughter, she had this pain in her stomach from she was 2 to 8 months or something. And every night, the mother-to-be had to carry her back and forth the floor in our flat, or going outside, and she was screaming, and it was terrible. It was like torture. We were desperate. But today, many years later, I think about those nice nights as some of the happiest in my life, because I was close to my daughter, I was close to the mother, I did something really meaningful in my life. So today, you know, it's happiness to me.
I'm glad you'll say that, because I'm having serious sleep deprivation at the moment and it's hell on earth. And I can imagine that I might look back at it in a romantic way and go, oh, it was dark and misty outside and I was there with my child. Whereas at the moment, I'm like, please sleep. Leading on from what you've just said, there's a great lesson learned that we all need to take stock of, and that's don't chase happiness, let it chase you. And isn't that notion of us all desperately chasing happiness perhaps one of the biggest scams of the modern world, which is founded, I guess, in sort of consumerism and capitalism, that we're chasing, you know, more or better jobs, so we can have more stuff and more things, and that meaning something?
Yeah, it's. I think it's almost insane.
Yeah.
And the whole idea that you're going to measure people's happiness throughout the day is, you know, it's crazy. And I think, you know, quite often, I'm not aware whether I'm happy or not. I saw this movie a few months ago, and a person said to another person that my big problem is that I'm happy when I'm sad and sad when I'm happy. I think that's a very good comment.
Yeah.
And, you know, life is so much more, you know, complex and complicated that, you know, we can talk about, you know, happy, you know, this kind of pursuit of happiness as a goal in life. It's the opposite. You know, you need to do something meaningful. You need to, as I said, get up in the morning. You need to, you know, try to, you know, live a rich life, do meaningful things. And then, you know, happiness will pursue you.
Yeah, I so agree, because there's so much less attention on having a purpose. Like, you know, what is your purpose? That could be anything. It doesn't have to be something grand or, you know, a huge challenge. But, you know, what is it? Saying hi to your neighbor every day or being kind to those around you or whatever. But what is that drive and purpose? Because I've certainly found that the endeavors I've had within my working life or outside of it that have been not attached to me looking for happiness. So it could be, you know, helping someone else or being part of a group of people. like you say, it just happiness turns up. You're not expecting it to, and you haven't been chasing it, but it's there. And then I guess there's also the willingness to let it go again, because it's not just necessarily going to stick around. And that's tough.
Exactly. And life is tough.
Yeah.
Life is super tough. So the whole idea that life could not be tough, that you can have this kind of happiness every day, throughout every day, it's not possible. So then to sell the idea is, you know, it's a kind of a scam to people,
yeah,
because life is hard.
Mm. I had someone the other day say to me, so I take it you're like the happiest now that you've ever been. And I was like, I don't know how to even answer that, because like right now, you know, sat here on the sofa, I'm perfectly happy, I'm fine. But what's to say, you know, in an hour I might feel bloody awful,
exactly,
or tomorrow I might feel even worse than I did when I felt really terrible 5 years ago, or I might feel amazing. Like, it's just undulating, isn't it? And ever changing.
And maybe on, you know, next week you go to a funeral to a person you were really fond of and you feel happy.
Well,
and then you go to a wedding and you feel unhappy. You know, life is complicated, and that's, you know, that's some of the beauty.
That's such a good point, because I, you know, we do associate those two extremes, like weddings and funerals, with emotions. And you know, obviously it's a given that it's sad to lose somebody. But I remember being at my great uncle's funeral, who I was really close to, and he was a great guy, a very amazing character. And it was really bucketing down with snow outside, and he had chosen Bob Marley, Three Little Birds, as his song. And we were all sort of smiling, and it was this moment of like absolute happiness that I definitely wasn't expecting to feel when I walked in there. But, you know, that's a really interesting point. It's just going to turn up when it does. And we have no control over it, I guess.
Very little control, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess there's, you know, is there a line to tread? Because I guess we have the agency to make good decisions, to be optimistic, or to, you know, do the things we know might help us out. But again, it's not expecting happiness to be at the end of it.
No. And I think, you know, if you have lived a happy life, I think you have to look at the whole life.
Mm.
And then you may consider if it was a happy life or not. But
yeah,
this kind of short-term happiness doesn't get you anywhere, I think.
And again, like when you talk about inner silence, is it the same with inner happiness? Like, we can achieve that on our own without it being attached to stuff, people, what's going on around us. It's just something we can sense within.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, I think in most people in England and Norway, you know, you need to be aware that most of the best things in life are for free.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you see, you know, if your girlfriend get herself a new pair of shoes, of course she's super happy.
Yeah, she's going to be happy for like 10 minutes,
exactly,
and then they get a bit boring.
Exactly. Or if you buy a new car, you're, you know, happy with the car until your neighbor buys a nicer car.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, some of the most important things in life, the most greatest things in life, they are for free. And keep it in mind.
Yeah. And then I guess I'll finish on this note. It's quite a big question. But, you know, we live, as you say, in this modern world, in the age of noise. Is there any going back on that? Can we reverse that? Can we live on a more peaceful planet? Or do we just have to learn to live with how it is?
I'm very optimistic on this. I think we will, we will learn to live with it. And we will learn to avoid some of the noise. It's going to be a hard lesson, but I think, you know, the future in general is great. I'm optimistic. It's going to be some hardship, but I'm super optimistic.
I think that's a pretty lovely way to end this episode, with some full throttle optimism. Erling, thank you so much. What an honour it is to have you on the city. It is, don't laugh. It's a big honour. You're a legend. It's an absolute honour. And I just think there's so many pearls of wisdom that people can walk away with. And so thank you. And thank you for writing your beautiful books as well.
Thank you.
Oh, I just love him. I heartily recommend his book, Silence in the Age of Noise, and all of his other books. Just go Google him. Wherever you get your books, go get them. And don't forget to subscribe to get your new episodes of Happy Place weekly, every Monday. You can do that for free wherever you get your podcast. It might be the same place that you actually get your books. That's the world we live in now. And also, to find out who's on next week's show, find us on Instagram @happyplaceofficial. Also, If you like listening to good stuff when you're driving in the car, out for a run, going for a walk in the blustery wind, why not check out my new BBC Sound show? It's called Sounds of the 90s, and I basically play 2 hours of non-stop incredible 90s music. I have 90s guests in the studio and talk about 90s TV, film and pop culture. It's a riot. Go check it out. A massive thanks again to Erling, to the producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, and to you for listening. Massively appreciate it. Have a blimmin' good week, and I'll see you soon.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.